if we look at the years from 68 to 82, what we're looking at for me is really is my whole career. You know, is the whole
you started in 68.
The whole period of time in which I've been working with any seriousness. You know, in 68 I was studying. In 68, I think Roy Kiyuka left Montreal. He had been my teacher for 2 years, and about which I was very unhappy. I was unhappy that he left because I had a very productive relationship with him, and it was because of Roy that I began to paint. Really, until meeting Roy, I was at McGill. I was doing classics at McGill, and
what you said by classic, it is
Greek,
Latin,
all that stuff. Yeah. And you know, had if I had any sense of where I was going, it was towards a scholarly career, you know.
But in 1968, you were just 19 years old.
Yeah, but I was already in my second year at college. Yeah. And, 1968 I was, I'd have to work this out. I was 20 years old in 1968. Yeah. And I was in second year of university. Okay. No, you're quite right. In 1968 I was still with Roy. Roy hadn't left yet. Roy left in 1969.
33 years.
That's right. And then in 1970 I ended up in London at the Slade School of Art.
Under Gaucher influence, you said.
Gaucher had gone to London and to set up the show at Whitechapel, and he visited the Slade because he knew Will Townsend over there, and Townsend was an interesting guy because he was the only person in London who really had a first-hand experience of Canadian art, because he'd been here several times and his daughter had moved here. She still lives somewhere out west, Charlotte. And so it seemed like a favorable place for a person like myself to come. At any rate, I spent a couple of years as any graduate student would in London. I left finally without getting my higher diploma several months before I was supposed to get it, because I was very tired, and because life in London was very difficult, and I was very poor, and it was poverty that drove me away from London. Because all the students I knew in London were poor, and poverty in London at that time was a much more difficult thing to support than than poverty in Montreal. You simply couldn't have any fun in London if you were poor. I was tired of it, you know. I had a terrible little cold studio in a basement, and I was tired. I wanted to come back. So I came back. I found this place 12 years ago.
This actual studio?
Yeah, the studio. And moved in and started to work. And got a little teaching job in a CIGE. My wife was working at the time, too, and, you know, we managed together. So looking at, you know, the development between 68 and 82 is really my entire life as a painter. And I think the really significant changes, if you're talking about, you know, there's an interesting, the use of the word démarche is very interesting. There isn't any real corresponding word in English, I suppose, development, or not really, practice, I suppose, is the right word. Mm-hmm. You know, practice in the Marxist term, maybe, you know, how you do what you do and why you do it, you know. I think the first few years after leaving school, I don't renounce them. I mean, the work from that time, I still have some of it. I've thrown out much of it. But it seems a little foreign to me now. You know? And I think the reason was that in the first few years after leaving school, you're terribly conscious, first of all, of being alone for the first time. And in those days, things like setting up cooperative studios didn't exist as an option, or we never thought of it, you know. Now when my students leave school, they set up collective situations for themselves.
Yeah, would you have been interested in those kind of gestures?
It's difficult to say because the ideology that you were fed during the 60s as a student was an intensely individualistic ideology. it was a modernist ideology, or one section of the modernist ideology, because of course there's a whole tradition within modernism, the tradition that's embodied perhaps by the Bauhaus or by Soviet constructivism or by any number of other movements, including the style and other groups, which are in fact collective in nature and collective in philosophy. But I think that you know, the dominance of American painting in those years and the dominance of the American approach to modernist ideology, which emphasized personality, it emphasized anxiety, it emphasized the struggle with oneself, etc., 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 it was really given to you pretty hard, you know, pretty strongly. There was very little humor in it, finally, you know. And so I you know, the notion of setting up a collective studio didn't really exist for me. I don't know how I would have responded to it had it been offered to me, you know, had it been presented to me as an option. But I thought when leaving school that the thing to do was to get your own place, lock the door, and get to work. And in fact, that's how the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ensued. And the interesting thing about working in Montreal was that it's not a city with a tremendously strong critical media. It's not a city where people question things a lot. It's not a city where people constantly question each other a lot. And it's very quiet. I mean, it's a city that doesn't have any galleries, didn't even then, has never really had them. It has a very small public, a small critical environment, a small artistic environment. And so it's, in some ways, a very peaceful city. And this is, I think, this has two edges. On the one hand, there are times when you may miss that environment intensely. But on the other hand, I think for a young painter who really feels like his first task is to find out what the hell he wants to do, what the hell he wants to say, it's nice to be left alone for 5 or 6 years. It's very good, you know? And since there's no particular pressure to make it, because he can't make it here, nobody's going to get rich and famous in Montreal, and everybody knows it, it's somewhat more relaxed. I mean, it's extremely rare for a painter 5 years out of art school to become well-known here. It happens even in places like Toronto, which are also provincial centers. But nevertheless, it does happen. Here, it doesn't happen that often, and I think that's very healthy. You know, it was very healthy for me, at any rate. And so that, you know, the peculiar kinds of things I did in the first few years, you know, some of which were governed by, I think, ideas or ideology, and some of which were governed by circumstances, like the kind of materials I used, for example, which were largely governed by lack of money. I mean, I used industrial paint because I couldn't afford good colors, and I couldn't afford to buy lumber, so I didn't buy it, so I started painting on stretch canvases, and in time, you know, when you're in touch with those materials, they begin to make their own demands, and so your work changes accordingly, you know. I think that having a steady teaching job and having an income and suddenly being able to have some more choices,
when that happened, the steady job
must have happened 72 or something like that, 73, you know, somewhere around that time, that I actually had enough money that I could decide if I wanted to start buying lumber, to start buying artists' colors instead of Pratt and Lambert, you know, wall paint.
Parce que dans Québec 75, il y a de ça, savoir que souvent les matériaux ont été choisis pour des raisons financières beaucoup plus que des exigences esthétiques.
Oh yeah, I think at the beginning that was certainly true. Although, I mean, look, all materials have their own properties, and all of them have certain attractive properties. I mean, the kind of surfaces you can get from certain kinds of car paints, for example, you know, are very particular to themselves, and Winsor & Newton doesn't give you those kind of surfaces, you know. But the fact is that if you have no choice but to use those colors, to use those materials, then that does govern what your options are, you know.
Est-ce que ça change le contenu de l'œuvre?
Of course.
In what choice?
Well, in the sense that And here we get right into, you know, here we get right into the most difficult question in aesthetics. Where, you know, where do we find the distinction between form and content? where do we draw the line between the body of the work, its physical entity, and what it means? You know, I don't think any hard and fast answer can be given to that, except that the fact remains very simple that all the works of art we have in culture, most of which have been made by dead people who no longer walk the earth, are objects. I mean, they're just, you know, so whatever content they embody or express is embodied in an object. Consequently, the material that they're made in obviously is a vastly determining factor. You know, if we're looking at a carving, a primitive carving made of soapstone, or another one made of sandstone, one must assume that whatever expressive properties it possesses are largely, are in great measure involved with material, you know? Mm-hmm. So, for example, those kinds of paints that I was talking about tend to have a flatter surface. They don't tend to look very good transparent. They look very thin, very washy. Oil paint looks fabulous when it's transparent, you know? It has tremendous body. 16 coats of transparent oil paint give you a particular kind of resonance, a particular color volume, that 16 coats of Pratt & Lambert wall paint are not going to give you. 16 coats of Pratt & Lambert wall paint look very much like 6 coats of Pratt & Lambert wall paint. It doesn't really make that much difference. They're very flat, and if you thin them down, they lose body, they lose color very quickly. I mean, they're not very rich in pigment. They're cheap, you know? So clearly, you know, the range of what's available to you as a means of expression is always limited by the medium. I'm not saying that artist oil color is not limited as a medium. Clearly, it has its own limitation. But I think they're far broader. You know, the range of possibilities technically is far broader with them than with industrial wall paint. You know, I still use this stuff. You know, I mean, there are moments when a particular section of a painting will demand something particularly dead, particularly chalky, particularly flat, particularly aggressive, when I might choose, you know, a commercial paint and do that section, you know. So, I mean, I feel perfectly free to use anything that's technically compatible, you know. If it's oil-based, then if I trust its permanence and its light fastness, and, you know, if I think it's a decent material, I'll use it. But I've become rather fussy in some ways, you know, in recent years, and I do find it more difficult to work with a paint which has a, for example, lower content of pigment or isn't properly ground and stuff like that, you know. I remember speaking to a friend of mine who lives down the street, who's a musician, who's an instrumentalist, plays a lot of string instruments, piano, saxophone, and I was sitting with him one evening, and he was playing with his banjo, and he just said, I have to get rid of this banjo. I said, why? He said, because it's, you know, it's a very good banjo, but it does not play what I hear anymore. 3 years ago, it could still play what I heard, but now I hear a lot more. Mm-hmm. And this instrument will not do it for me anymore, and I have to get rid of it, and I have to wait, I have to save the money, I have to put together the $3,000 or $4,000 it's going to take me to buy a handmade banjo of the kind that I need. And until that time, I'm not going to play the banjo anymore. I'm going to put this thing aside. Et and I think, yeah. Continue.
Parce qu'une question, j'aimerais poser.
Ouais.
C'est en 68, mm-hmm. tu dis ça débute. Mm-hmm. Mais présentement, tu parles de tous les aspects techniques, les moyens techniques mm-hmm. qui étaient mis à ta disposition, ou physiques, ouais. ou des outils.
Ouais.
Mais quand tu débutes en 68, que tu veux être, ou que tu veux, ou que tu es un artiste, mm-hmm. qu'est-ce que tu cherchais en 68? Comme artiste. C'est-à-dire, est-ce que tu cherchais une justification dans le fait de travailler, ou bien encore, tu sentais que cette justification n'était pas nécessaire, et qu'est-ce que tu voulais dire à ce moment-là?
Yeah. I think that starting out from art school, I don't think that the question of justification or the notion of whether it meant anything for me to spend my time, my life doing this, mm-hmm. really occurred to me.
J'étais décidé que je serais à peindre.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was pretty well it. And it didn't, in fact, occur to me until the first time I really ran into a very serious block, you know, which didn't happen for a few years. For a few years, I worked very comfortably. I mean, when I was, the work that I was doing at that time had to do very much with materials. I mean, I was confronted with unstretched cloth, which had certain properties, which basically couldn't support drawing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when you're dealing with a piece of cloth that's not flat and that's going to have ripples and bumps and it's irregular and it really very vocally shows its physical qualities, illusionism of any kind is really impossible, you know? And so what I thought confronted me was, what shall I do with this stuff? What can I do with it that's interesting? It was a very typical formalist problem. Mm-hmm. Very typical formalist problem.
Ça,
yeah, very much.
En 68, non seulement tu avais décidé d'être artiste, mm-hmm. mais déjà tu avais décidé que tu serais un peintre.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Le reste est un peu intéressant ou à ne pas être considéré ou hors de
sujet. Well, it's interesting, you know, because I knew as a kid that I had other talents. I mean, I wrote, mm-hmm. and I have a good musical ear, mm-hmm. and I'm not uncultivated in the fields of literature or music either, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly when I was going into university initially, I was uncertain, you know, which way I would go. And it was really meeting Roy that decided me on several counts. First of all, I had never met anyone who actually did this as a life, who actually did this every day. So that was a revelation in itself. He was a guy who not so much did this as a living, but did it as a life, you know? And the second thing was the realization that I was never going to do anything very good in all three fields. I mean, I literally had to do one or the other, you know? And the others would have to take a... Would have
what
to
was
take
it for you?
Hmm?
It was
literature, it was writing, and it was music.
Okay.
And it was painting, you know? In all of which I had some abilities, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the crucial thing was meeting Roy, you know. And it's interesting because Roy, of course, is very involved in literature also.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing is that by the time I met Roy, he wasn't painting anymore.
Yeah.
He'd given it up. He was making sculpture, and
it was
very clear that he was going to give up sculpture also. So it's interesting that that Roy influenced me to become a painter at a time when he himself had decided to stop being one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what implications this has, you know? I'm not sure. Nevertheless, I know that in terms of sculpture, it's merely a matter of how can I put it, talents. I don't have a talent for sculpture. As any student, I was forced to do it for a certain time, and I didn't do it well. I have, which is interesting because certainly in the modern era, sculptors are among my very favorite artists. I mean, Brancusi is one of my absolutely very favorite artists. Giacometti is one of my absolutely favorite artists. And there are several others, you know. But I can't do this stuff. And I find it very, very difficult to imagine the back of something, you know. I think what interests me in painting at this point, one of the things that interests me in it is that it's a very reticent art. It's not an environmental art. It's not an art form that comes out and grabs you like music does. And music is irresistible in that respect. If it's present, you may not keep it out. I mean, you have to block your ears, and even then the vibrations of the sound are going to enter your body. It is something that if you don't want to hear, you must remove yourself from the premises, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Painting is not that kind of art. Painting is an art which holds back a lot, and it's something that you have to come to. It's a very quiet art form, and I think that gives it particular qualities, which perhaps lead it somewhat in the direction of the more meditative or the more intellectual, perhaps the less, I don't know, charnel, corporeal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking to a student at school, a couple of weeks ago, who's English, and I pointed out to her, I asked her, in fact, why she felt that there was such a minor tradition of painting in England, and a fairly strong tradition of sculpture, at least in recent years, you know? Mm-hmm. And the answer she gave was really quite interesting. I mean, she felt that it had to do with the same reasons why there's such a strong tradition of empiricism and positivism in England.
But you said empiricism, empirisme.
That in fact, empiricism, I mean, that empiricism finds its initial impulse in England and its real home, and the positivist philosophy really has survived in the English-speaking world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than... And that this has to do with the inclination of the English towards perhaps the more material, the more physical expression that sculpture gives, you know, which, of course, shares your space with you. The painting doesn't share any space with you at all. It's entirely fictional, you know? That interests me. At any rate, to go back to that, if we're going to follow the development chronologically, and I think that the reason I stopped using those materials and began to stretch canvases and paint on them in a more traditional manner was because I wanted to draw again. It was because I wanted to have the freedom to make a certain gesture that had certain implications, that could have ambiguities, because on the loose canvas there were no ambiguities possible. It was entirely concrete. It was really flat sculpture, flat colored sculpture. And the impulse came at some point to draw, you know, to start drawing again. And it came after the first trip I made to Italy. And
74, 72?
When was it?
72 or so?
Yeah, 73 or 74. No, it was later than that.
Later than that, after Quebec's fall.
That's right. It would have been 77. Yeah.
Just before the exhibition, 78, six for Pouce.
That's right. It was 77. And from the moment I started doing that, I felt entirely at home, you know. And I think at the same time, I began painting less in response to the materials and more in response to what I wanted to see.
Okay.
And
change
the process to the
message.
I think so, yeah. I don't know if I'd call it message, certainly.
Not message, but content.
Internal content, I think, certainly, you know. I mean, I remember the typical way in which I used to start a painting in those other years. I would stand at a big table and I'd have a chunk of cloth in front of me and a big pair of scissors, and I start cutting without any particular notion of where I was going, and the painting in some ways made itself, you know, because the process of folding the canvas, of coloring it in certain ways, of making demarcations, was very much generated by the object itself. And in some respects, although I enjoyed the process tremendously at the beginning, towards the end of it, it began to feel as if really the painting was making itself through me rather than my making it. And I wanted to make it. And, you know, I began to desire.
Ce dont tu parlais, c'était quelque chose qu'on appelait dans le temps l'art génératif.
Well,
l'art
I don't know.
Générer lui-même.
I suppose so. I mean, yeah, I suppose so. Of course, I don't believe that's true. I mean, I think philosophically, I don't think it is. I mean, I think it's a logical. I think it's an error. I mean, art does not make itself. I mean, art is a human product made by people out of needs and desires of all sorts, including the desire to make something that feels like it makes itself. I mean, that also is a need. I think the need to be outside of it that perhaps accounted for so much of the sort of objective-looking art that we had in the 60s, detached art where the artist was not present. That also is in a response to a certain kind of desire. I mean, it's interesting that these desires come in waves, and they, you know, they come and go, objective, subjective, etc., etc. You know, now we're in an era of tremendous subjectivism, and all my students want to spill their guts on the canvas, you know? It's interesting. I mean, they're still the same kids that wanted to be very objective and detached 5 years ago. They're the same kind of kids. The world has changed, perhaps... perhaps it's less optimistic than it used to be, you know?
Mais qu'est-ce qu'il y en est présentement pour toi en 82, quand tu fais tes tableaux? En quoi t'as...
Well,
pas nécessairement t'as changé, peut-être t'as évolué ou quoi, mais... Comment décrirais-tu? T'as décrit le début un peu? Maintenant, si on décrit la fin, ce serait quoi? Pas la fin. finished.
Well, I'm not sure. Why don't I just, you know, I could describe to you the typical way in which a painting proceeds for me. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's typical for me, and I don't think it's untypical for a lot of other people. I mean, I don't think it's particularly special in that respect. Usually when a picture finishes, and I work on them one at a time, generally, even if I have two in progress, I never work on both of them together. I can't concentrate on more than one thing at a time, and they go rather slowly. I mean, an average picture takes me about 3 weeks to a month to complete, you know? So I don't make that many in a year, and as I get older, they seem to get slower, and that's just the way it's gone. I mean, I have no idea whether it's going to continue in that direction or perhaps speed up or God knows what, you know? So generally the thing that happens at the end of a painting is that I feel very empty. And I feel like I have nothing else left. And I wonder if I can start another one. And in fact, I don't begin a painting unless I have some notion, some more or less clear notion of the kind of, I don't want to use the word image, the kind of feeling or the kind of situation I would like to find myself in, you know, which normally comes with a sensation of shape or a relationship of shapes or colors, etc. It can come in a number of different ways, you know.
Est-ce que tu es formaliste?
No, I don't think so. You know, no, I don't think so. I mean, how would you define formalism?
Dans un sens large, savoir que le formalisme, premièrement, c'est un mouvement, mais le formalisme aussi, je le verrais comme une, au niveau philosophique,
mm-hmm.
comme une attitude de recherche de la forme dans l'espace qui correspond un peu à l'image aux effets de l'œuvre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Le formaliste interprète un niveau de. Elle suppose, elle pas interprète, mais suppose un niveau d'interaction entre l'image et le producteur et que le chêne est à l'extérieur de lui-même. C'est comme ça que je comprends le formalisme. C'est abstrait.
Ok, that's very. I find that very vague. It's a very vague description that you've given me. In fact, it's so vague that I can accept it for myself, you know? I've always thought of formalism as something somewhat more detached than that, somewhat more objectified than that.
Parce que le formalisme est très ordinairement très précis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
J'utilisais le mot formaliste dans le sens...
Yeah.
Parce que le formalisme, c'est l'histoire de l'art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, certainly what I'm looking for is something quite precise, but... Or something quite concrete, or something quite complete at any rate.
Besides concrete and complete, par rapport à quoi?
Well, here we get into some interesting and difficult to describe ideas or notions. An internal image, okay? An internal state, okay? An imaginative state. I don't know how else to... Let me continue.
Okay.
So along with that initial kind of notion comes a certain sense of what kind of scale it might have, of whether it might be vertical or horizontal, in nature, whether it might be larger than myself or smaller than myself, etc., etc. So I can actually begin to prepare for the thing by building a stretcher and, you know, making the support and sort of, you know, doing all the sort of menuiserie and all that kind of shit that has to be done beforehand. And then I begin. I mean, and the curious thing about it is that the minute you make an attempt to touch this notion, this dream, which felt very whole, which felt very complete, like a body, you know, with a head and arms and legs, a certain kind of completeness. But the minute you try to seize it, it appears to be incomplete. It appears to have no head, no feet, a big hole in the center, God knows what. But suddenly it's very fractured, you know? And that's a very anxious time. And and it takes up the larger part. I mean, trying to rescue the initial notion, or to find whatever notion it's leading to, takes up a good two-thirds of the process. And I paint and repaint and shift and push and, you know, move it around and let it go through whatever transformations it seems to want to go through. And at that point, it's really, I think it's quite intuitive, and because I don't really know where I'm going all that well. And if the painting is going to succeed, if it's going to become a painting, then at some, and it doesn't always, but if it's going to, then at some point, I suddenly recognize what it wants to be. At some point in that process, I recognize what it wants to be. And it's quite a clear recognition, usually, even though the painting itself may not have any clearly defined form at that point. But the moment of recognition is really quite sudden, and it's usually quite clear. And from that point on, the process becomes absolutely pleasant for me, because at that point I know what I'm after. And it becomes an exercise of talent. It becomes an exercise of technique. It becomes an exercise of...
genius?
No, not necessarily. No, when I say talent, I mean...
Capability?
Capabilities and experience and technical resources and all the things that, you know, the pleasure of applying the paint and knowing how it's going to work, you know, the knowledge that this particular black is going to go matte and this particular black is going to go gloss, the enjoyment of certain sensuous qualities that the thing might have. And I follow my nose at that point. But I can follow my nose because I already know what I'm after, you know? Like, I've seen the animal, you know? Like, I know where it is, and it's just a question of patience. And it might take 2 weeks after that point, you know? But I'm not anxious anymore. I mean, I've seen the victim, and I just have to circle around long enough and catch it, and then polish the thing, you know, like take the skin off and clean it and bring it to the point where I think it exposes itself really clearly to me, you know? And there are two odd sensations that are associated with ending a painting. Three odd sensations. The first one is, and I described this to you in my little letter to you last time, the first one is a feeling of melancholy. For several reasons. First of all, because it's not as good as you thought it would be. It's never as good as you thought it would be. Which I think, by the way, is the same
fear.
Did
in one case,
fear.
At least it was more. It was better than...
Well, yes.
At least equal to what you think it will be.
How do you mean?
But you're saying because melancholy, because it's never as good as
well,
you
no.
think it will be, but at least one time or another it succeeded.
Well,
yes, it is what I want
yeah.
to do.
Well, the quote I quoted to you in that letter from Gilson, who's mm-hmm. one of my favorite philosophers, by the way. I mean, even though he's a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, I love him. He's really
le rat du possé,
it's wonderful. I mean, what he says about it is, he says, you know, at any given point when you're creating an object for which you have no model, apart from the extremely tentative model of your inner state or your image, which is very fragile and very tentative and really depends a lot on faith. You know, it's not a model in the sense that a craftsman has a model for what a good pot should look like, you know? That any time you're creating an object like this, at any given point, when you make a decision, you also make a decision not to make several other decisions. I mean, you choose a direction and reject several others. And the fact is that any one of those other directions could have been more fulfilling, more beautiful, better. And you're aware of this, and of course, and as you get to the end of the work, there are fewer and fewer possibilities. There are fewer and fewer options left. You're driven more and more into the corner mm-hmm. of concluding this thing, which you've discovered, and which you always doubt whether, in fact, it could have been much greater, much more complete, much more satisfying, etc., etc. So I think that the aura of the possible disappearing it towards the end of a painting is precisely what accounts for this kind of melancholy, you know? And I think it's also the same fear that accounts for blocks, for writer's block and painter's block of being unable to start. Is, I think, largely the fear that, and it's a very well-founded fear, that it will never be as good as you promised to yourself or that you promised to other people. That no book you ever write will be quite as good as you thought it would be. No painting you ever make will be quite as beautiful and quite as moving as you thought it would be. And this can really work you into total paralysis sometimes.
But what are the referentials to tell you that it will not, that it will be good or bad or less or...
Well, the referentials are interesting. What are they? They're very difficult to put to pin down. I mean, if I just reply, you know, with the most sort of awful cliche that it's intuitive knowledge that, you know, that, now intuitive knowledge is based on something too. It's based on the experience of other works of art which have given you completeness and a pleasure. Although the experience of other works of art which give you completeness and pleasure and that kind of satisfaction, a certain aesthetic satisfaction, are never quite the same as the feelings you get from your own. You know, but I suppose that is one of the sort of major models, is that you want to be moved by what you do in the same way that you are moved by Goya, you know. I suppose that's why kids become artists. I would think so, you know, is because they're moved by something. I would suppose that that's why kids decide to pick up an electric guitar, because they heard Jimi Hendrix one night and it just blew them away so much that they said, really, I want to do this, you know.
That's your case.
Well, yes, I think so. Well, it depends how far back we go, you know. At the.
Okay, qui étaient les artistes qui t'ont ému, pour ce mot-là, je pense très précis.
Mm-hmm. Well, very early on, what we call primitive painters, medieval painters. One of the really earliest loves I had, apart from medieval European art, which I was always very moved by as a child, always, was Greco. Loved El Greco. I mean, I remember being 14 or 15 years old in high school and just taking books home and just getting completely freaked out by the atmosphere in the thing, by the contortions of it, you know? By that wonderful view of Toledo, you know, which is, where the hell is it? Somewhere in the States. It's in the Met, I think. No? Where is it?
Toledo.
Is it?
Okay.
Anyways, I've seen it once in my life and I can't for the hell of me remember where.
But first you were moved by image, seeing the catalog or books or something.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember, you know, I can remember that the first passion I conceived for painting, I think, was through reproductions. It wasn't through painting itself.
Mm-hmm.
Although I remember as a kid being, you know, being in art galleries in Warsaw and seeing, I remember, for example, seeing a show of Mondrian, you know, a small show of Mondrian, in Warsaw when I couldn't have been more than 11 years old. And I remember it
and
quite clearly. No, I don't think I was seized by it, you know?
Integrated maybe, but not seized.
Not seized, no. Not moved the way I was later on as a teenager when I first saw Greco.
In reproduction.
In reproduction, yes. Yeah. Right, right. And by religious art also, you know, by medieval art also. And I remember that the first trip I took to Italy, I was looking for, you know, Duecento and Trecento painting.
Mm-hmm.
And instead what I got swept away by was the Renaissance. And I hardly looked at the earlier stuff at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, 5 years later I went again, mainly to look at Tintoretto, and I was swept away by Titian and Giorgione. I didn't look at Tintoretto hardly at all. So, I mean, you know, these things happen. I mean, you go looking for one thing and you find something else, and that's all there is to it, you know? Venetian painting still is, you know, is really important for me. It's important for me in terms of color and space and a certain nobility, you know, that's really very important to me, you know?
Parce qu'une question qui est intéressante, c'est le fait de... En tout cas, c'est rare que les artistes admettent que leur première la première source d'inspiration, la première, pas source d'inspiration, mais source de création, on pourrait dire, le premier stimulus, vient de reproduction.
So what? No?
It did. So what? It did. It's ordinairement, on ne l'admet pas. Toi, tu admets complètement. C'était la culture que tu avais sous la main.
Yeah, exactly. It's what I remember. Sure, it's what I remember, you know. I mean, I drew and painted pictures, as any kid who is encouraged to do so by his parents does quite a lot. I mean, I do that with my kid. Most parents these days do that with their kids. I don't know if they did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but I think my parents did, you know, so that the habit of drawing and painting was always with me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just never took it very seriously, really, until I met Roy. It was always a hobby. I drew cartoons, I drew portraits of people, something I did, you know, as a lot of kids in high school do, who have some talent and, you know, try it out. It wasn't something I took particularly seriously until I met Roy, who was, as I said, the first example I ever encountered of somebody who lived by that, for whom it was like the driving force of their life. And that was an important important meeting.
Mais qu'est-ce que Roy, qui a fait, disait ou faisait, qui fait que ça a tant d'importance?
It's a difficult question to answer because you're asking a question about Roy's whole sort of persona as a...
And your relation to this
persona. Yeah. First of all, I was struck by the man's energy and by his cultivation in many disciplines and in many fields. I mean, he was a very literate man, he was a very musical man, he was a man who was terribly interested in cultures other than his own, you know, and who dispensed these things very freely, you know.
Good teacher.
Oh, hell yeah. Very talented teacher. And, you know, and I think that really is a special talent. I mean, I think some people have it and other people don't. There are people who are talented teachers and not talented artists, and there are other people who are talented artists and not talented teachers, and there are some who are talented in both respects. I think they're very lucky, you know. Because for them, teaching is, you know, doesn't have to be a burden, it can be a pleasure, you know, which it is for me. You know? I think those who find it a burden are merely unlucky. I don't think there's anything they can do about that. I think it's a question of temperament. Some people like walking into a room filled with other people and interacting, you know, and they get tremendous charge out of it and they get energy from it. I do. I mean, I get to my evening classes sometimes at 6 o'clock and I'm very drained. I mean, I've spent like 6, 7, 8 hours here. I'm pretty exhausted, you know. By 8 o'clock, I seem to have got an infusion of energy, and by the time it finishes at 10:15, I feel like I could keep going for another couple of hours, you know. So I get a lot out of it, you know. And it's the only really social collective outlet I have, because I still do this in a very solitary way, as I did at the beginning, you know.
So the same studio.
Yeah, in the same studio and same space. And so the collective contact that I have, the social contact that I have, is largely through that institution, and I value it enormously, you know. And I feel I'm very active there. I mean, when I'm there, I'm not asleep. You know, I'm really present. I mean, I have bad days like anybody else, but generally speaking, I think I'm really very present with them. You know.
Finalement, tu es un homme heureux, un artiste heureux.
Oh yeah, I think you could say that. I think you could say that. I think I'm doing the right thing. For me, you know? Anyways, where did we leave off? Oh yeah, this business of finishing. So there's the melancholy of ending the picture. There's the panic of having to begin a new one, because at that point you really don't know what it's going to be. You've been so involved in the last one that unless you're very lucky and something has bubbled up inside for the next one, you're left feeling very empty, you know? Or I'm left feeling very empty. And I feel almost as if I've been caught unprepared, you know, for the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a period of time passes, once you've started a new one, that, you know, you leave that painting alone, the last one, and it sits there by the wall, and you get distant from it. And after a time, I think the melancholy dissipates. I think it's possible to have a little more of that recul, that kind of distance from it. and to judge it for yourself, to evaluate, what has it brought to you that means anything, you know? For me, as I said to you in that catalog, in that letter, in the last few years, it's been largely through, how can I say, the medium of memory, that it feels like memory. It feels like, not quite a déjà vu, but it's tinged with the smell of something that I have seen or felt or heard. Very often it trips off associations to places, a particular street or a particular piazza or a particular river or a particular window in a particular building. Once in a while, I'll begin a painting from that too. It doesn't happen very often, maybe 2-3 times a year. I don't go sketching when I travel, and you know, so I don't have too many records. I have a camera with me. Sometimes I take some photographs. I don't do it religiously, you know. Once in a while, I'll actually begin a painting with the remnants of a memory of a particular scene, place, or object, you know. And it may be a sign beside the highway, or it may be a doorway, or it may be the corner of a building or a curbstone. It tends to be a man-made thing rather than a natural thing. I can't remember the last time I actually sat down and drew anything that had resemblance to a landscape. It tends to be man-made or human, in fact. And I think for the most part, when I look at these pictures, I face them as if they were figure paintings. Or I face them as if they were... Yes, I face them as if they were figure paintings rather than landscape paintings. And I think the verticality has to do with that. And the fact that I'm generally not satisfied with them until they kind of acquire the density of a body, you know? Like a certain kind of...
Density of...
Of a body, d'un corps,
body.
You know? And usually, at the point when I feel like I can suddenly see where the painting is going, it acquires that kind of density. It acquires that kind of centeredness, you know? Which is why I think I have such a strong tendency to the vertical. And sometimes I fight it. You know, the last 3 or 4 pictures I've done have been almost square, because I felt, well, maybe this is just a habit. Like, maybe it's just a rut. And let me see if it's possible, you know, to spread the thing, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it obsession? You know, I mean, do I have to do this, you know? Like, what if... What if I had to stop doing it? What if I had to open it up? You know, could I do that? So the question is, like, what is, as far as the milieu is concerned, what constitutes the milieu for me, you know, as a working person? Mm-hmm. Well, first and most importantly, the institution that I teach at. And as I said, this is where the majority of my interaction with other people involved in making art takes place, you know. Secondly, the gallery, you know, mm-hmm. my relationship with Michiko and other artists in the gallery, which is quite good and productive and fairly comfortable, you know. It's a comfortable relationship.
And third, I would say, it is also the fact that you have been involved in exhibitions, like Quebec 75,
right, and the third
Repair, and other
right, things. Right, right. And the third thing.
Sound, design, yeah. Or something like this.
Which is, you know, which is interesting from the point of view that these are decisions made by other people, in a sense. I'm invited by other people. I mean, other people decide for reasons of their own that somehow I fit in together with 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 other people that they've been looking at.
Mm-hmm. With you some want to start by the last point? Because you said Concordia, the gallery.
Sure. So
let's
go on
exhibition.
With
exhibition.
With some of which people I feel a great deal in common,
mm-hmm.
and with some of whom I feel nothing whatsoever in common. You know, so since this tape is just between you and me, we can be candid about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm hanging in a room now at the musée with Christian,
mm-hmm.
whose painting I not only don't understand thoroughly and have very little sympathy for, but who I think paints like a grandmother. I mean, I don't feel any real kind of power and pulsion and energy in that painting, and I'm entirely bored by it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, nevertheless, in three exhibitions I've been hanging like 3 feet away from the guy, I think it's somewhat humorous, and I'm certainly not bothered by it. I think if I can hang three pictures of my own, it's sufficient to show on a certain level what I do. Now, you know, in the show that you curated and in this show,
in 79 at the museum?
Yeah. I've deliberately each time gone and chosen three, or in that case, four paintings which were as dissimilar as possible. Now, it's possible that this can create some confusion in some people. I realize that. It's a certain risk. From a certain point of view, one could even maintain that these three pictures could have been painted by three different people. I think anyone who has seen my work over the years will not get that feeling. I mean, the family resemblance is quite clear, and for anyone who's acquainted with the progression of the work, that's not confusing. For someone who doesn't know the work, it may be somewhat confusing. I'm willing to let that chance happen. I'm not disturbed by it. I think what's important, though, is, and I want to insist on it always, is that I'm not a party line painter. I don't have a program. I mean, every painting I make, you know, starts from like nothing except a certain desire to see something. And I don't censor it, you know? If it wants to go hard, if it wants to go soft, if it wants to go dry, if it wants to go wet, if it wants to go red, if it wants to go blue, you know? If it wants to go central, if it wants to go spread, if it wants to, you know, I let it go.
That's the last third of your painting, what you were talking about.
Mm,
you're going to a two-third of the painting. At one point, the painting is going
by
itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to say by itself, because the point is that when I recognize it, it's mine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've made the fucking thing. It's not happening there by accident, you know?
No.
I just received an invitation to go to a little conference in Toronto where artists are going to talk to each other, and it seems it's largely a modernist group of artists, most of whose work I don't appreciate particularly. And they sent me a list of questions, and one of the questions was, I think I have it in my pocket, was does content take care of itself? Something like that. Does content, content, does it take care of itself? You know? Nothing takes care of itself in art. You have to take care of it. I mean, for Christ's sake, it doesn't appear, it's not an object of nature, it's an object of culture, it's a man-made thing. It, you know, like my paintings exist because I wanted to see them. You know?
Okay.
I mean, nobody else is going to make, would have made that green painting. You know?
No. Sure.
Nobody, you know? I mean, it may resemble any one of a half a dozen people you can think of. It doesn't matter. The point is, that particular painting is a result of my particular desire to make it and my particular effort in trying to find it. And having found it, my particular efforts and attention to completing it, you know, and bringing it to the fullest point that I could, okay?
So to reposer my question,
mm-hmm.
ça voudrait dire que jusqu'aux deux tiers, construit, on pourrait dire, la question où tu situes le tableau, et dans le dernier tiers, tu es en confrontation avec la question que le tableau pose et que tu t'es posé toi-même au départ.
I think so,
et donc tu laisses.
Yeah, that's right.
Autrement dit, tous tes tableaux sont vraiment faits, on pourrait dire, par toi-même.
Oh, absolutely.
Et ne dépendent d'aucune grille, d'aucun programme préétabli,
rien. I mean, sometimes, I'll tell you. And this, I'm sorry, gets back to the other thing I was talking about, just for a moment. But I mean, I was talking about this tendency towards verticality and centralization, this kind of vertical core of density, you know? And sometimes, I'll begin a painting, like I began that painting to the left of the green one,
mm-hmm.
with the red and the gray, in an effort to kind of spread the image from side to side, you know, to really open it up, not to have this center. And I mean, I worked on that painting for a good, like, 2.5 weeks, and in the end, it just began to irritate me tremendously. I mean, it had this kind of very classicist, balanced, it was like a man in a tuxedo, you know? It was like, had a white shirt and tie, and it had nice broad shoulders and the whole trip. It was very clean, you know? And at one point, I just felt I had to, like, shoot the guy, you know? And I just spilled some red paint in the middle, and it spread, and suddenly, like, the red center happened, and bang, I'm back to, you know, I'm back to that, I'm back to the middle, I'm back to the heart. And that's, all of them seem to, in the last few years, find this kind of gravitational pull towards an area which exerts a lot of density and a lot of pressure. It tends to be centralized, and tends to be vertical also, which is why I look at them as if they were figures, as figure painting, really, you know? Although I'm completely not interested in drawing human beings. I mean, that's never interested me. Even in art school, it didn't interest me, you know? But nevertheless, as how can I put this? As forms of energy, they seem to me figure-like, you know? Mm-hmm. At any rate, so to get back to the exhibition business.
No, before you came back with the figure, avant de revenir aux expositions, ce serait justement, tu en parles beaucoup, tu insistes beaucoup, et comme on parle de, du milieu, choses comme ça, est-ce que tu considères que ta peinture ici dans le milieu est quelque chose de tout à fait isolé au niveau des images, c'est-à-dire qu'elles sont produites à la fin, le tableau est terminé? Ça, je pense que c'est à peu près certain, c'est des choses assez isolées. Est-ce qu'il y a des relations? Parce que jusqu'ici, on a parlé de Rai Kiyoka. Est-ce qu'il y a des relations en dehors de ça?
Well, you know, there. It depends how you mean by that. If there are, if you mean relations in terms of, first of all, in terms of people with whom I have close contact, you know, the two painters with whom I have closest contact are Chris Knudsen and Eve, you know.
Personal contact?
Yeah, personal level. I mean, people whom I visit frequently, or who visit me frequently, people who watch my work develop and whose work I watch develop, people with whom I have, I tend to frequently have, I don't know, theoretical discussions about this or that, you know? These are people with whom I'm in touch, you know? Now, the notable thing, of course, is that I don't paint like either of them, you know? But, nevertheless, I mean, certainly in the case of Evie, he's a man whom I, respect tremendously. And some of whose attitudes, I think, have rubbed off on me to some degree, you know? I just think that in terms of, just to get back to this exhibition business, just for a moment, okay? I don't know, I think that there are expectations that exist in the minds of people in the art field of how an artist develops. Or how, you know, please with your application send 20 slides of your work, you know, and God help you if there's not a clear connection between 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 20, you know, God help you if you should show that sometimes you go backwards for half a year, sometimes you go sideways completely, and you change your mind and you go back to the middle, and then you go forward and then you go backwards, which is exactly what happens in all our lives, you know. Or at least it happens in mine, at any rate, you know?
Yeah.
Also, I feel like, I want to feel absolutely free to paint any picture the way I want to, period. Simple as that, you know? And it seems to me that it's interesting. It's in the visual arts that people insist on this kind of homogeneity of production that they don't seem to insist in the field of music, for example. I mean, nobody ever reproached Benjamin Britten for writing a trumpet concerto in May, and writing a choral work in June, and in July writing a solo piano piece, very spare, very lean, and 2 weeks later writing a quintet for strings and piano, very rich and very harmonic, and then writing a solo clarinet piece in the fall. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever said, Britten, for Christ's sake, what are you doing? How come you're not following a clear line of development?
So you are, you know, comme ça tu es contre, c'est-à-dire.
Yeah,
cette espèce d'image.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Painter image, image painter.
Absolutely, absolutely, you know, absolutely. I want to have the freedom to choose my means with every painting, and to choose the way I want to go. Until it satisfies me, and I'm not and. Specifically, I'm not interested in any painting that seems to me a repetition of what I've already done and a restatement of what I already know. I'm not interested in what I know. I know what I know. I'm interested in what I don't know. You know.
Mais tu admets qu'il y a une unité stylistique entre les tableaux.
I think it's self-evident, and I think it's unavoidable, but it's not a concern for me. You know what I mean? I think when I look back over a year's production, I can see that I can see that this painting is a father, and this painting is a little brother, and this painting is like the crazy cousin, and this painting is the old aunt, you know? I can see the family, I mean, I can see the family developing, and each of them with their particular kind of personality. I can see that this is like, that this painting engendered this one, and I can see that this painting is a reaction to that, being engendered, and I can see that, you know, I can see all these things in retrospect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not insisting on that relationship. I don't have to insist on it. I mean, I'm involved in these paintings to the fullest extent that I can, and therefore, and I'm not worried about resemblances or continuities or anything of that sort. You know, I'm assuming that it's taking place.
Okay.
You know? But I do, you know, but I do insist in every exhibition to somehow impress upon the viewer that what I do has great scope, that it has great range, you know? And so I will often deliberately choose paintings that are very much unalike, very much polar opposites, you know? And show them, yeah.
Tu as fait dans six propositions, qui étaient quatre tableaux.
Right. Or these three that are up now, which are perhaps even more sort of, perhaps surprisingly sort of different in terms of means and in terms of their whole sort of presentation, you know? I mean, one of them is kind of a Russian-looking painting, and it seems every year I paint at least one of those, you know? And one of them, the sort of scrapey, brushy one, is maybe a little more typical. If you can choose a typical painting out of those three, maybe it's that one. The third one with the strange kind of curvilinear, sharp kind of image that looks like a, God knows what, a fetus or something like that, is was a surprise to me. I mean, it's a painting that I did not expect to go that way. But the fact is that once I found it was going that way, it assumed a certain importance, and I pursued it to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's complete. It is what it set out to be, in a sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm perfectly happy to show it, you know. To a certain degree, I let the other guys make a choice too. I mean, they have their opinions, and you know, mind you, there were three of them, and there was some disagreement among them, and that's normal too, you know.
Jusqu'ici, on avait ouvert la bande sur le phénomène de ta relation avec les milieux. Justement, on est retourné dans les problèmes parce qu'on a parlé d'exposition spécifique.
Yeah.
Mais par contre, j'aimerais avoir ton point de vue. On reviendra peut-être plus tard sur ta peinture, tout ce dont on parle présentement.
Oui.
Mais qu'est-ce que toi, tu penses du milieu actuel au Québec? L'état de la peinture au Québec, l'état
well,
de l'art
I don't know.
Au Québec,
I'll tell you, it's funny. I mean, painting has a very small audience, okay? I think I've accepted that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
est-ce que l'art,
the quote, the fine arts are not the dominant cultural expression of society. They're not. The dominant cultural expression of society...
In any society or in
well,
this
no,
society?
Well, no, in this society.
In this society.
In Western industrial society.
Okay.
Okay? No, I mean, obviously, folklore in other societies may have a completely different relationship to the social structure that art has here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're going to look at the dominant visual culture, I mean, as Peter Fuller said, if a Martian came down to Earth and said, you know, came down to New York or came to Montreal and said, and looked around for the dominant visual culture, he would look at TV, he would look at advertising, he would look at movies. If he looked for the dominant musical culture, he would turn on the radio and he would listen to, you know, Dire Straits and Led Zeppelin and, you know, whatever. Maybe Wayne Newton, God knows what, Frank Sinatra, I don't know, you know. Whatever's happening at that time. Commerce, industry, I mean, we're talking about commerce and industry at that point. This is an industrial culture. These are handicrafts, for Christ's sake, what I'm making here. This is not industry.
Mm-hmm.
The movies are industry. The pop music business is industry, okay? In that respect, that culture machinery represents our life here much more accurately, you know, than what I do. I mean, what I do has a very limited audience. Look, what I do is like somebody who's an organist and is interested in 17th century French organ music. You know, and there are maybe 75 people in Montreal who are devoted to 17th century French organ music, and when he plays at Marie-Laine du Monde, everybody goes there. Those 60 or 70 go there, and there's a certain milieu of understanding and acceptance, etc., etc. Now, painting doesn't have quite that small an audience, but it's a small audience, okay? I've accepted this. I mean, it seems to me that that I've made a choice. I mean, you know, that the kind of art that the kind of art that I practice has is perhaps you know, has relationship has sources that are too tied up with the personal, with the meditative, that it doesn't really impinge on that world out there very strongly. It never will, and I don't think there's any real need for it to. You know, I mean, if you say to yourself, well, what responsibilities do you have as a human being in society? I would say, well, as a citizen, you have tremendous responsibilities in society. And if, in fact, you want to put your particular talents in the service of those responsibilities as a citizen, then there are all sorts of different ways to do it. Mm-hmm. Other ways, you know?
Parce que la question que j'aurais maintenant, est-ce que c'est justement pas par le fait que tu es professeur à Concordia qui te donne une source financière,
oui, oui.
Ben, disons, pas suffisante, mais abondante d'une certaine mm-hmm. façon? Est-ce que ça, c'est ça qui te permet de peindre? Et finalement, c'est est-ce que ton rôle social n'est
pas
d'être un professeur?
No question. No question. First of all, you know, look at the straight economic facts of it, you know? The fact is that I don't have to sell my paintings to live. Mm-hmm. Okay? I make, in the average year, maybe 30 to 35% of my income selling paintings. It's never been higher. Some years it's lower, you know? And I realize that among contemporary painters, that's not so bad. That's pretty good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I may sell like 4, 5, 6 paintings in a year, maximum. More often 3 or 4, you know? I sell about a quarter of what I paint. I keep about 3/4, you know? The fact is that the fact that 2/3 of my income comes from another source, and a source of which I don't think is a rip-off. I mean, I think that I'm, you know, that what I give is good value for money as a teacher. I'm not fucking around in there. I'm not wasting time. You know, my relationship to my students is interested and intimate, and I get pleasure out of it, and I think they get pleasure out of it. And I'm not, you know, I really don't feel like I'm stealing from anybody when I do that. I'm not picking their pocket, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm a good teacher, and I think students know that. I mean, I don't question that, you know. No, it gives me a tremendous amount of freedom. I think so. Look. It gives me the freedom not to have to run around to try to sell my work like a crazy, you know? It gives me the freedom perhaps not to have to compromise
mm-hmm.
in certain ways, you know? I mean, I have a friend who's been living in Manhattan for 8 or 9 years, and, you know, he's had strange things happen to him that I've never had to face. He's had dealers come into his studio and say, look, I don't really like what you're doing right now, but I really like what you were doing 3 years ago. And if you think you could start doing that again, then maybe we could make a deal. I think I could sell these things. I think they're very good. And he would say, well, get out of my place, you know, open the door and get out. And half an hour later, he'd say to himself, my God, I mean, the rent has to be paid, the food has to be paid, the electricity has to be paid. Why don't I do it, you know?
Mais est-ce qu'on peut dire que finalement, c'est le fait d'enseigner à Concordia te permet de peindre?
No, it does, it's not that it permits me to paint. I think I would paint no matter what,
yeah.
You know? But it permits me to paint perhaps with a little more time and a little more independence and a little more security than I would otherwise. Look, I mean, Ed Reinhardt said that, you know? Like, painters should be in academies of art. They should not have to worry about earning a living. They should not have to sell their paintings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was said in the 60s. It's a very different era right now. It's an era where, like, the social contract is breaking down all over the place, where the absolute insecurity of financial life is just crushing people all over the place.
Je dirais ceci, tout simplement, c'est que si je vois quand je t'ai vu en 75, il y a 7 ans,
mm-hmm.
et je te vois aujourd'hui, tu es beaucoup plus détendu face au fait de peindre, c'est beaucoup moins dramatique, tu es beaucoup plus sécurisé, c'est sûr que c'est l'enseignement des sources financières.
No, because I don't think it's that, because I don't think the financial thing, I don't think the security of earning a living for me has changed in the last 6 or 7 years. It's remained absolutely the same. I now work on 2-year contracts instead of 1-year contracts, so I have double the security, but it's not much. I mean, mm-hmm. it's something I could lose very easily, you know? No, I think that if I feel more relaxed and more secure, I know my painting a lot better than I used to.
Ah, okay.
I really do. I really know my painting. I think that...
Donc l'insécurité qu'il y avait en 75, c'était beaucoup plus une espèce de crainte devant les tableaux que tu faisais en 75, que plus que l'état financier de l'année en cours.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't had a really serious kind of crisis of imagination in a few years. Mm-hmm. I've been running very smoothly. Even during the times when I break off and I go away for a month for a holiday or something like that, you know? Or have to stop painting because... things at home, you know, things with my kid or things with my house, etc., etc. The daily things that people run into stop me from doing it for a couple of weeks. I may get a little nervous after a few days and want to go back to it, but I'm not seized by security comes from much more from that, from you know, from the experience of having been through a couple of real kind of crises where I didn't know what to do anymore, and I had to stop, and I had to go away. It happened once, you know, the first time I went to Italy, it was really at a very low point. I mean, I really didn't know what to do next, and I felt like I gotta go away.
Before going.
Yeah. I gotta go away and find out, do I want to keep doing this, you know? Is there anything else that I want to do, you know? And when I came back, I was filled with it. I mean, I just...
For what reason you were so at the low point?
Well, I think largely that the attitude that had supported me for so long, the certain kind of process that I had used, had just run out. I mean, you know, I had
process as a painter.
Yeah, I had other needs. You know, I'd been making these folded canvases for, you know, X number of years, and I'd really come to the end of it. And I mean, I really had no idea where to go next with it. I mean, I remember maybe it was similar to like the day when I don't know, when Yves finished painting his gray paintings and painted R69, that crazy red
Everything
painting,
was
you
over.
Know, like it was that red painting was a real freak out. It was like a real heart attack, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised he destroyed it, you know. I mean, actually, he didn't need it anymore. Once the therapy was finished, he was into another thing, you know.
When did it occur in your case that you?
It would have been around 76, 77, you know?
For what reason it happened?
The muse didn't come. I don't know. I really don't
what?
Know.
What? The muse? Yeah. Les muses?
Sure. I don't have an answer to that.
Tu étais vidé.
It's a dark cloud, yeah, you know. I mean, the thing that I had, the process that I had clung to seemed empty and insufficient and stupid. Mm-hmm. It didn't satisfy me. I couldn't do really what I wanted, which was to draw expressively, and but I had done it for so long I didn't know what else to do, and it was a real crisis. You know? Now since then I've passed a couple of little ones also, like a month or two, you know, where I just feel very let down and I really feel like I can't paint another picture. But I've passed through them all, you know. I've passed through them all by stubbornness and by good habits and by being here every day and just pushing, you know. And
being a good worker.
Yeah. And I know now that I'm going to pass the next one. You know what I mean? I mean, I have the security that I'm going to pass the next one.
So now...
It's going to come. It's going to come.
Ça veut dire que maintenant, t'es parti. On peut plus t'arrêter.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you can't ever say that. You know?
Non, on peut même plus t'arrêter parce que toi-même, tu peux pas t'arrêter.
Yeah. Yeah. It can leave. I think it can leave. I've seen it leave certain people. I mean, I think people do have peaks, you know? And but you never know. You know, as Guido says, a bad painter doesn't know he's a bad painter. You never know. Thank God. I mean, it's a blessing, you know?
Yeah, you're not a bad painter.
No, but the point is that I could turn into a bad painter. I could turn into a painter who's banal. It's possible, you know? I hope that my own critical faculties vis-a-vis what I want to see and how I approach the things that I want to see, like the vision that I have, the dreams that I have, the things that I want to see embodied in a painting, is sharp enough that when it begins to get dull, I notice, you know. But you can't always guarantee.
So
these
now you are trained to be a painter in your own world.
Well, I mean, I've gone through. At any rate, I've gone through enough crises to know that they will come, no matter what you do, they will come, and that that it's possible to survive them. They're not final, you know? But in the last few years, they've been minor. They've been really minor. I've been moving, like, comfortably, you know? And the crises, when they come, are really very minor. They're short, you know? Mm-hmm. I may get stopped up for a couple of weeks, or I may make a painting that that I can't conclude, you know? Again, you know, you're talking about what does it mean to finish a painting? What kind of model do you have? How do you recognize that a painting is finished? How do you know that? How do you know the image is complete, since you don't have a model, like a potter has a model, or like a Baroque composer has a model? You know, he writes a trio sonata, and it has certain given structure. I have very few givens, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's experience. I mean, I think that you begin to develop a smell for, like, when you see the thing in the forest, when you see the animal moving, and you know that it's your own. Mm-hmm. You know.
Tout à l'heure, tu as été vu par un peintre précisément. Est-ce que tu considères que dans le milieu québécois, beaucoup d'artistes ont cette qualité de savoir quand est-ce qu'un tableau est bon, ou plusieurs n'ont pas la capacité de juger qu'un tableau est bon? Considères-tu que le milieu, finalement, si on parle de peinture, est très vivant ou quoi? J'aime le mot du milieu.
Well, très vivant, I'm not sure. Suffisamment vivant, yes, I think there's enough there, you know? You know, I think there's a handful of good, solid painters in the city that interest me, you know? Some of them are older, some of them are younger.
At your generation level?
Hmm?
At your generation level? At ton niveau d'âge? Peu?
Not that many, no. As painters, no, not that many, you know? Yeah, I mean, I like Luc's painting quite a lot, you know?
Qui?
Luc. Bellin's painting.
Bellin.
Yeah. Some of the younger guys, there are some younger guys, you know, in their 20s that I think are very interesting, you know. I got a couple of my students who are dynamite, just dynamite people. I got a little girl named Céline Surprenant, who I think is one of the most amazing people I've ever seen at her age. I don't know how old she is, maybe 20 years old. Every week I come in and my jaw drops open. I can't believe what's going on there. I mean, I compare her to myself at 20, and it's just no comparison.
Quelle est sa chance, elle, d'être exposée? Est-ce qu'elle aura la chance que toi tu as eue, c'est-à-dire Québec 75, etc.
Well, that's I don't know how to what degree that's dependent on her. It's largely dependent on the institutional milieu.
Est-ce qu'elle a une chance?
Yeah, I think so. Sure, why not? I mean, you know, she
has. Non, pas comme artiste, mais comme est-ce que le milieu va lui donner sa chance?
I think so. Sure. Look, what's she gonna do? She has no money. She's going to get herself into a collective studio of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
There are two or three along the street. I'm trying to find a place for her right now. She'll find a place, okay? It's not going to cost her too much money. She'll have to get a job. She has one already. She works in a hospital, you know, as a orderly, a nurse's aide or something like that. It's a dirty job, but she likes it, you know? Okay, so she's got that. She's very tenacious. She's very smart. She's very talented. She's very dedicated. She's going to make it. What's she going to do? She's going to exhibit at Articule or at some of the alternative places 2, 3, 4 times. Sooner or later, somebody is going to see it. Somebody's going to see it. Somebody's going to start including her in group shows. And somehow, I mean, commercially, there's not that much, let's face it, there's not that much happening in the city. And there never has been that much happening in the city. It's nothing new, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been an era where there's been a really lively scene for collectors in the city. There isn't. I have one collector in the city, you know? So what, you know? Most of what I sell seems to be to corporate hands. I'm not happy about it. But that's the reality. There's not a hell of a lot I can do to influence it. There's not much that she can do to influence it, you know? But she'll get a chance to be seen. I don't know if you're asking, will she get a chance to make a living as a painter? Probably not. But she'll paint. I'm convinced of that. And I've had, over the years, maybe a dozen people like that who have continued to paint and who impress me tremendously. Because I think that the times they're living in are much tougher. I mean, for me, it was still possible to get a teaching job. For them, it's going to be virtually impossible. It's an option that they just have to remove. It's simply not in the realm of possibility for them. I mean, education is like it's a diminishing field, and there's just not much chance, you know? So I realize, you know, that the struggle is going to be much greater for them than it has been for me.
Mais pour quelle raison, j'ai oublié le nom que je viens d'entendre, cette fille-là, comment se fait-il qu'elle est... Je pose la question, comment se fait-il qu'elle est un bon peintre? Parce qu'elle était de naissance, peu importe où ça se passe, elle l'aurait été.
Well, to begin with, I think she's talented. That means that she has...
Elle a les moyens de faire...
Well, I think that she has, just in the same way that certain people have a good ear, and a certain singer can sing you a fifth or a seventh, or difficult intervals, because their ear is good, and they have the capacity to do it physically, okay? Second of all, she has a sensibility which I think is partly given and partly trained. I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere along the line she had good, sensitive teachers in high school, God knows what else, you know? People that I ran into when I was a kid who really sort of pushed me in the right direction.
Mais est-ce que dans le milieu québécois, est-ce qu'elle va continuer à produire suffisamment pour faire des œuvres? C'est-à-dire, est-ce qu'elle pourra produire des œuvres?
Why not? Why not? What do you think?
C'est ma
question. What could stop her, you know?
Je sais pas.
I don't see it.
Mais pourquoi continuerait-elle de travailler dans ce secteur-là? Si à la fois elle était mélangée dans le milieu hospitalier où elle semble retirer un certain plaisir, pourquoi une journée elle ne serait pas... complètement une infirmière, rien à voir avec la peinture. Elle peut quitter demain matin.
Well, it's possible. I'm not suggesting it's not possible, but I think it's a need.
Qu'est-ce qui va la garder?
Look, it's a need. Look, it's a disease. Let's face it, okay? It's a disease. It's a disease, and I think for some people it's a real terminal disease. You have it forever. I mean, it's.
Mais qu'est-ce qui fait que c'est un disease pour quelqu'un?
Well, it's a hard one to answer. I don't know. I mean, for me it's very clear. Look, this is a vehicle, an expressive vehicle that suits me, that suits whatever abilities I have, and that I can push. I can push it to its limitations, and I don't know what those limitations are, but I can keep pushing it. You know, and you know, the problem is just like to keep working and keep pushing those limitations, and this is the vehicle that's suitable to me. I mean, I found that it's suitable to me. Now, it's quite possible that I could have taken another way somewhere along the line at 17 or 18 or 19, and have become a composer, or a novelist, or a scholar, which I had intended to become.
And you would have been again.
Anyways, you know.
Category.
Yeah,
in
certainly. That's there's no question about that, and I think that's largely
but
a question.
In the case of this girl.
That's largely a question of upbringing, you know. Yeah, but she's already. I mean, look, she comes from. I'm surmising. I'm supposing that she probably comes from a fairly solid bourgeois background, where education has been nurtured and has been valued. She's a fairly cultivated girl. She reads. She thinks. These things don't happen in a vacuum, you know.
Okay. Do you consider that in Quebec society or any society, that's a basis for being an artist?
I think in most cases it is, but not in all cases. I mean, I've also met a sufficient number of kids who come from working class backgrounds, in which an environment, social environments, the street, the school, the neighborhood, in which certain tendencies they might have had to be thoughtful, to be intellectually curious, to want to read, etc., etc., were probably not encouraged, and these kids have had to struggle tremendously in that environment. Mm-hmm. Although normally, if you look at it carefully, you find somebody along the way, a parent or a teacher, or some source of support that's turned the kid on and, like, just pushed him in the right direction, you know, because in fact that's the direction it's taken. It's taken the direction of school, and it's taken the direction of reading, and it's taken the direction of going to movies, not, you know, not junk movies, but good movies, of picking up interesting books, of reading the newspapers, you know, of not listening to, like, Shom FM, but to the CBC, you know.
For what reason do you consider that art is the right direction?
Well, I'm not suggesting necessarily that it's the right direction, but it's a direction And art is not necessarily, that's too limited a field, you know. We're talking now generally about
culture,
yeah. Which seems to be a possibility for certain kinds of people, you know, and seems to be a need for certain kinds of people, you know. It may turn in other ways. I mean, there are lots of... well, it's perhaps too wide open a question. But I think that for the most part, most students that I've had that are, you know, seriously involved, come from some sort of supportive background, either in the family or socially through school or something like that, you know? And if they're lucky enough to run into teachers that turn them on, you know, then it continues and has a chance to grow, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting, by the way, that it's like, that it's the right thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do for some people.
Okay.
I think it's the right thing to do for some people because it gives them it puts a vehicle in their hands, it puts a tool in their hands for a kind of growth for which they have the capacities, they have the abilities, they have their own internal tools to grow with it, you know? I mean, in the same way that there are some kids who are you know, inclined scientifically or mathematically, that if they're given the opportunity to move into that milieu where scientific thought or mathematical thought is encouraged, you know, whatever they have intrinsically, whatever they have genetically, is going to get a chance to grow, to get fulfilled, you know?
So at this level, do you consider that what art is, what is the state of art in Quebec, is giving really something to society?
Well, no, I don't think it's giving a hell of a lot. I mean, if you're looking at society, again, if you're looking at society globally, in terms of its development, its social and political development, then I don't think art is a motor, an engine in that. I don't think it ever has been. I think there have been...
It was supposed to be in Quebec with Refus Global and Dr. One thing like this. 1948.
I think it was an illusion. In the same way as constructivism was an illusion. I think it was an illusion to think that art could be at the forefront of the social revolution. It wasn't true. Politics was at the forefront of the social revolution. The Bolshevik Party was at the forefront of the social revolution. Maybe it didn't even belong there, but it was. That's where it was. That was the motor, you know? It wasn't art. And I think subsequent developments proved that it was there only as long as it was convenient.
Or they were removed, or they were not at the edge.
Or they were, yes, both.
Both?
Yeah.
If they are removed, maybe they were at the edge.
I wonder.
You have the kind of answer to those problems.
I wonder. Well, I have one answer. I'm by no means certain of it, you know? If you ask yourself, what would have happened if Lunacharsky had lived another 20 years?
And the question is in your case, are you working for yourself
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
your friends and a large area of friends or possible friends? Or
right.
Are you working for your heart or art pieces in one way? Or are you working for society, or are you working for the world at large? A thing like this, because they are the
yeah.
poles of confrontation.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, you know, I think my answer to all those questions would be, in each case, yes,
mm-hmm.
but diminishing yes. Certainly for myself. If you say for my art, no, not for it. I mean, for the sake of these paintings existing, it means nothing to me. I mean, these are a tool. These, as far as I'm concerned, they're a vehicle, they're a tool, you know?
Tool of what? Tool for what? Excuse me. Self-expression?
There are certain form of thinking as verbal language is a certain form of thinking, and as mathematics is another form of thinking. There's a certain form of thinking, a certain form of living
mm-hmm.
that that allows me to gain certain kinds of knowledge. Okay? Certain kinds of intuitive knowledge. And so certainly for me, certainly for my friends, certainly for the small circle of people who are actively interested in watching the results of my work and the results of their own work, and in decreasing, in levels of decreasing influence for anybody else who comes to it without prejudice, obviously, you know? Mm-hmm. And as it goes farther and farther, obviously, there are fewer and fewer people who come to it without prejudice or without making demands on the work that the work can't support. I mean, needing to see certain things in it that the work simply doesn't fulfill. You know, do I think of them in really global terms of like the history of Western culture? No, I mean, obviously not. All it would take is a small fire in this place, they'd be gone, and the world would never notice, except for a few people, you know? They have very little importance in that respect. And I don't...
It's not an easy answer?
No.
This little fire?
No, what do you mean by it's not an easy answer?
You see that a fire and everything is done.
Sure.
Suppose there is no answer. No fire.
Suppose there's no fire. Well, look, I mean...
Why not?
The survival of these objects, if I were to die tomorrow, you know, would be largely dependent on forces really outside of my control. Would be entirely dependent on forces outside of my control.
Which
forces? For example, well, the valuation that these things have within that portion of society that cares for these things. In other words, the institutions, the museums, the collectors, etc., etc. That means largely their commodity status. You know, mm-hmm. Which is partly influenced by aesthetic status, but that aesthetic status is constantly being influenced by their commodity status. Are they worth anything? You know, is anybody going to make any money off of them? You know, is it worth keeping them? You know? If it's quite clear that it's not worth keeping them as commodities, then
who
they
will decide?
Then they will probably disappear.
Who
will decide? The executors of my will. My gallery, you know, whoever owns them, you know, whoever decides to do whatever they want to with them. Now, obviously, they're not going to have, I mean, I'm very, very much a regional painter. I'm not really known outside this city. So the chance of them surviving as commodities, you know, in the world of art is very small, you know.
So do you think that they must have larger support in one way?
That they must have? For my own fulfillment? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. For the moment, I'm quite content to stay here and paint with the limited audience that I possess here. And if it weren't for reasons of commerce, I would never even bother going to Toronto, even for a visit, you know? I have a space in the city where I can show. There are people here who have followed my work over the years and who appreciate it, with whom I have a nice, warm relationship and who care about it.
Who are those people?
Who are those people? They're partly other artists and they're partly the small community of people who look at painting and enjoy painting and appreciate it. They're people like Jean Leduc and people. There are people like Roland Poulin, people who leave me notes in the desk when I have a show. You know, and I get lots of them. And this is, and it's happened every time I've had a show. I get these little letters from people, and very often from people whom I haven't seen for years. And you know, mm-hmm. It's very affirming. It's very nice. Now,
you are producing inside a small community of people.
Very much. Now, but you know, by the time
it is the goal of the paintings, of your production, is to say.
No, it's not the goal of my production. It's not the goal of my production, but the production is surrounded by it, and therefore, it's not negligible. You know, I mean, by the time that I'm ready to show a picture, and I have a show every couple of years, I don't show things that are brand new. I let them sit for a while. I know these paintings pretty well by then. And I'm not anxious about them anymore. I really can honestly say that I don't care if anybody likes them or not anymore.
Because they require, not a question, a remark. Mm-hmm. It is to say that your security maybe you are having a certain security from a Concordia as a teacher, and there is your security, and now you are free to paint. There is no obligation for the painting to be a help in your survival or something like this. That's a good description of the situation?
Possibly. I think it's one description of the situation. I don't think it's total, you know.
What would be a total one?
Well, I'm trying to elucidate that, you know. I'm not sure what the total description would be. I certainly think that if you're thrown without any support on the open marketplace and you have to support your family on the sale of your own work, it becomes intensely competitive. And when it becomes intensely competitive, you have to make global claims for the value of your art. That is, it is better than his art, and it's better than his art, and it's better than his art, and you should buy it instead of them. Okay? These are claims you have to make, because you're competing in the open market, and you're struggling
for
survival.
Are you doing those claims?
I'm not. I don't have to. That's the whole point. I'm making the best painting I can at this moment, and it's better than I was making 3 years ago. I think it's clearer. I think it's...